Hello and welcome to our urinary tract system part 3. Today is all about pathology. What can go wrong in the urinary tract system and how you can detect some of those things based on the symptoms and the presentation. So before we begin, we're going to briefly talk about how you can talk to people about this stuff. And I want you to know that it's not meant as medical advice. It's not meant as replacing a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare practitioner. It's about education. It's about teaching people what has gone wrong, what the underlying causes of that might be, and then eventually getting to giving them some education about what they can do to repair balance. So make sure that you are always including some sort of a disclaimer before you talk to people and present to people and give them suggestions based on education. So what are some of the common urinary tract systems? Let's just get the language down. Polyuria means that there's a profuse amount of urine. Not necessarily that they're peeing more frequently than usual, but that there's just a very large volume, and that large volume is not consistent with the amount of fluid that they're drinking. Pelvic pain. Pelvic pain could be pain in the front, and then back and flank pain. Kidneys usually present with back and flank pain, and if you're not careful and you don't know what it is, you can mistake it for musculoskeletal system problems, like a strained muscle or a dislocated joint or something along those lines. So those are important things to be able to differentiate. It can also present with high fever, and the combination of fever with back or flank pain, wow, that's usually going to be a kidney infection. Bladder infections, which we'll talk about in a bit, do not present with fever in general. Tiredness, malaise. I remember the only time in my life I ever had a kidney infection, it came on with this just feeling of exhaustion. And I was like, what the heck's going on? I'd been pushing myself and not sleeping and trying to get things done. And all of a sudden I felt exhausted. And I said, I'm going to go lay down, which is very unlike me. And I'm going to just see. And I went and laid down and I started to feel my back hurting. And I just felt completely exhausted. So I happened to have some dipsticks where I could check my urine, just those little, very inexpensive on Amazon. A box of 100 is probably like $12. And I tested my urine and I saw that I had blood and nitrates in my urine, and I got a fever and I was laid up for 4 days. I did all natural approaches, didn't do anything other than that. But I remember that feeling of exhaustion was so amazingly difficult to deal with. Cloudy urine is another one. So the urine starts to look cloudy, and then we end up with blood in the urine as well. And those are also indications of either an infection in the kidney or the bladder. The kidney will usually have the blood. The bladder won't in general, but the cloudy urine can be a sign of both of them because it's from the bacteria. Increased urinary frequency. So not just a lot of urine like we talked about with polyuria, but frequent urination and urgency. When there's an issue with the urinary tract system, especially when it's in the bladder, like an infection in the bladder, the urgency is there. It's like, I have to pee, and then hardly anything comes out. So a lot of symptoms here that would indicate that there's a problem with the urinary tract system. Nocturia, waking up in the middle of the night to urinate, and that could be frequently or once or twice, but we shouldn't need to wake up in the middle of the night to urinate unless we just overdone it with the drinks and beverages in the evening, or we've been drinking alcohol, and then burning in the urination. So these are obvious. Just wanted to go over it, make sure that the language is there. Let's talk about the individual problems that you can find. Cystitis. We think about cystitis as being a bladder infection, when indeed most of the time it is a bladder infection, but it's just really inflammation, cystitis, itis being inflammation. The causes are usually bacteria from the stool that cross-contaminate or bacteria from the skin. Very common is what they call honeymoon cystitis, that some women are prone to bladder infections, to cystitis, and on having intercourse, the partner and, you know, bacteria from the partner, but also from their own body that ends up into the urethra because of the activity down there. Less common causes could be yeast infection, a viral infection, or even chemical irritants. Now, some people have what's called interstitial cystitis, which is really like in the wall of the bladder. It's inflammation, and it's usually caused by allergens, like food allergies or chemicals that get in there. When it is an infection, the most common organism is E. coli, and these can be cultured. We can do a dipstick to see if there's indications, and then if there are, then you can go and have a culture done. And if there's bacteria there, you can actually get a culture done, and usually they're going to find E. coli, but it sometimes warrants others if it's chronic and it's not going away. Here's some signs and symptoms of an actual urinary tract infection, and you'll actually see that there's a lot of overlap with the first sign, which said signs of problems in the urinary tract. So polyuria, frequent urination, painful urination, increased urgency with a small quantity. That's very common in the infections, especially bladder infections. Cloudy urine, bloody urine. Bloody urine is usually related to the kidney. Urine that smells worse than your normal. Normal urine should not smell at all unless it's been sitting in the toilet for a while, or it's very concentrated due to dehydration, or there's an infection. Pain in the pelvic area, fever with a kidney infection, and then intermittent throbbing flank pain. And that's the key word. If somebody says that they have throbbing pain and it's intermittent, it comes and it goes, and it's in the back, one-sided or two, it could be just one, then that is a red flag for you to be thinking of a kidney infection. So the other thing we have is incontinence, like people who actually can't hold it, right? And it's common, and as we get older, for females, because of the estrogen levels dropping, and apparently estrogen, especially estriol, has an effect on the tone of the bladder wall, and we lose it, right? Especially jumping up and down or activity. Common, but not normal. Causes of incontinence can be urinary tract problems like infections, a prolapse of the bladder, kidney stones, or an obstruction somehow. There could be neurological causes like MS, where the whole neurology is affected. There's weakening in the musculature, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's disease. There can also be weakness and damage to the muscles of the bladder, and that could be from childbirth. That could be from any number of reasons. Oftentimes, a calcium-magnesium imbalance can be at the root of incontinence, so that's something that we can look at. Certain medications, if they're on medications, make sure you look up those medications to see if the symptoms are one of the underlying causes. And then female hormones. So during pregnancy, because of the extra weight of the uterus and the inability to hold it, childbirth can cause some weakening of the pelvic floor muscles. Menopause, when the estrogen, especially estriol levels go down. And then, of course, hysterectomy, when we've removed all the parts of the system and there's no estrogen to be found. Male kind of causes enlarged prostate, right? We know of men who cannot hold their urine, or they're peeing constantly, they have this pressure, or they can't start their stream, in any number of things from an enlarged prostate or prostate cancer as well. And then other causes that we may not think about are diabetes, hypothyroidism, constipation, and being overweight. So it's really important, if somebody's saying they have incontinence, you want to know, is it general incontinence or stress incontinence? Is it incontinence when bouncing up and down, jumping on a trampoline or a rebounder, running or jumping, or is it there all the time? And that's going to help you to differentiate what the causes are and really take a look at what we've got here to make sure you rule out or in some of these particular underlying imbalances. So kidney stones, the technical term for that is nephrolithiasis. They're also called renal lithiasis. Renal and nephro are other words for the kidneys. And when they're in other parts of the tract, it's called urolithiasis, uro being urinary tract. So they're hard deposits that are formed in the kidneys, and they're made of minerals and salts. Sometimes they're uric acid, sometimes they're oxalate. sometimes calcium. And what happens is that the concentrated urine, so dehydration can contribute. So concentrated urine will cause some of the minerals to crystallize and form deposits. Also, vitamin B6 and magnesium deficiency can contribute because they tend to bind to the oxalates and urates and drag them out of the system. So when they build up, it can be super painful, especially if they get lodged in the ureter. And you can see by the size of the ureter here, it's very narrow. And while it's in the kidney, it may not cause a particular pain problem, but once it starts traveling down towards the bladder and it gets stuck in the ureter, that's when people are doubled over in pain. It's very, very painful, but usually doesn't cause permanent damage, but it can be scraping cells off, which is the cause of the blood in the urine as a result. So blood in the urine can be indicative of a kidney infection or kidney stone. You can see what they look like once they get into the bladder. And then once they're into the bladder, they're pretty easy to pass. But before that, people say they wish they were dead. So let's talk about the connection between fructose and kidney stone formation. Well, high fructose consumption, which is, of course, in all the sodas and beverages and so many of the snacks and even savory type snacks that have high fructose corn syrup added for the bliss factor. And it's linked with increased excretion of calcium, oxalates, and uric acid, besides which it puts a lot of strain on the liver and affects the blood sugar balance dramatically. So soft drinks with phosphoric acid increase the calcium excretion because the phosphorus displaces it and the formation of kidney stones. So soft drinks are like a match made in heaven for kidney stones. Also the sweet teas, you know, people get these sweet teas. It's very common here in Texas. Let me have some sweet tea. The biggest dietary causes of kidney stone formation because of the fructose and the phosphoric acid. And also there's tannins, tannic acid in the caffeinated teas, for sure, the black tea, which is what people usually use. So who's at risk for kidney stones? Well, here's a nice little chart. And the chart is put together to show a column with the risk factors, some of the causes, the treatment, and the level of evidence. And there's some indications in there. So for places, if you want to go further, there's some studies. So when there's low urine volume, right, people are dehydrated, they're sweating a lot and not replacing. That could be caused by exercise, low fluid intake. A lot of people are just not drinking enough water. And you must talk to them right at the beginning about water. You can't keep going with more sophisticated nutrition and lifestyle changes unless they're drinking enough water. And then the treatment would be increase the fluid intake. And then there's a reference. Hypercalciuria, too much calcium. Well, that could be just who knows why. It just happens sometimes. It could be a parathyroid imbalance. It could be vitamin D toxicity. And what do you do? Well, you reduce the sodium intake, and that will often help with excreting more of the calcium. Diuretic, and there's natural diuretics. They docs want to put them right on medications, but the natural diuretics, dandelion and parsley and cucumber and celery and all these things, and increasing the dietary calcium to 1,000 milligrams because of the interference between that and sodium. Hyperoxaluria, that's a risk factor. High oxalates, it could be genetically programmed, genetically predisposed, or it could be eating a lot of high oxalate foods and having a leaky gut, because technically the oxalates shouldn't even get, or not a significant amount, shouldn't get to the kidneys because they are usually excreted in the gut. But when there's a leaky gut, they leak into the bloodstream and then they find their way to the kidney. So dietary ingestion, right? Endogenous metabolism. Too much vitamin C can cause it, can cause the conversion to oxalates. And of course, the diseases that are impacting the permeability and increasing the gut permeability. So what do you do? Well, initially you restrict oxalate intake, but you also have to fix the leaky gut, heal the leaky gut. So another cause would be hypocitrituria, so low citrate in the diet. So that could be caused by renal tubular acidosis, other metabolic acidoses, and chronic bowel disease. And the treatment would be potassium citrate involvement, right? And then avoiding going on a more alkaline diet so that we don't get into this acidosis and healing the gut. Another risk factor is too much urates in there, uric acid, and that would be purine ingestion if you're sensitive to it. Excess purine ingestion, as in animal protein, too much of that can add too much uric acid to the urine, and so we reduce purine ingestion. Finally, increased sodium excretion. So if we've got a lot of sodium, that could predispose people to kidney stones. It has an effect on the calcium as well. So it could be excessive dietary sodium. Most people are taking in way too much. We really should have it be, I like to see it 1,000 or less milligrams a day, 2,000 at the high end, but most people are doing 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams of sodium every day because it's added. Salt is added to so many of the foods for, again, similar to sugar, the bliss factor, to make people eat more of these, you know, junky kind of snacky foods. So restricting sodium intake, as I said, to, I'd like to see it at 1,000, but between 1,000 and 2,000 milligrams a day. So let's talk about glomerulonephritis. So nephritis, meaning inflammation in the kidneys. Glomeruli, if you remember from our first part of this module, we've got the little glomeruli in the middle of the kidney, and that's the filtering mechanism. So there's either acute or chronic. In the acute form, it's sudden, possibly after an infection in the throat or on the skin, that causes it, it cross-reacts into the kidneys. On a chronic level, it can develop silently over several years, and it's just little by little by little, the symptoms build up. So the symptoms of the acute are facial puffiness in the morning, brown urine or blood in the urine, and urinating less than usual. So these are some of the symptoms you want to look for, and it's usually been associated with a strep type infection in the throat or on this, or a staph infection in the skin. Chronic, it develops silently, and the symptoms would include blood or protein in the urine, high blood pressure, edema, frequent urination, or foamy urine. And these may be things that people don't even notice until it becomes blood in the urine. And even then, most people don't notice blood in the urine because it's usually not like a pouring out of blood. It's subtle. And you would only detect it when doing a urine test. So I recommend people, I do this in my programs with folks, I have people buy the dipsticks, the urinary sticks, and be able to test their urine on a regular basis, especially if they do have hypertension, noticing edema, especially pitting edema in the ankles. Pee a lot. People say, I pee a lot. It's just normal for me. It could be a chronic, asymptomatic, or early symptom of glomerular nephritis. And then foaminess in the urine is actually one that people do notice pretty early on. Kidney failure is another problem. Kidney failure can happen where the kidney just stops working. Why does that happen? Well, there's a loss of blood flow, urine elimination problems, so difficulty with removing, getting rid of urine. It could be from an enlarged prostate that isn't going on, isn't noticed. It could be from frequent cystitis. It could be a blood clot in or around the kidneys or an infection. An overload of toxins, and guess what? Most of the people that we see are overloaded with toxins just from eating the standard American diet and using all the products that people use, and to say nothing of the air quality and toxins in the air, and it's just, there's a lot of that going on. Drugs and alcohol. So many people take over-the-counter medications. They take prescription medications. They take recreational drugs. And alcohol is like considered like everybody should drink it. It's kind of crazy to watch even parents giving their teenagers alcohol and drinking it like it's nothing. And it's an addictive substance that damages the liver, the brain, and the kidneys. Vasculitis. So diseases of inflammation in the vascular system. Lupus and even other types of problems that are autoimmune that affect the kidneys, like glomerulonephritis, that'll affect the kidneys and it will stop, they will stop working. One of the early signs of kidney failure is that edema in the ankles and like feeling short of breath because it affects the heart. Hemolytic uremic syndrome, multiple myeloma. These are all underlying conditions of imbalance in the body that can cause kidney failure. So thrombolytic thrombocytopenia, that's small platelets, chemotherapy drugs, dyes from imaging tests, like people who get those tests over and over again. I don't think they're putting themselves at big risk to have that done once or twice, but some people, because of past cancers and past other things, are getting these on a regular basis. Certain antibiotics and uncontrolled diabetes. Diabetes affects the kidneys big time. Diabetes affects the peripheral nerves. It affects the retina, and it's one of the leading causes of kidney issues. So this is why we do what we do. We help them with their digestion. We help them with their blood sugar and nutrient balance. And a lot of times we're looking for fancy cures. You say, I don't know how to handle kidney failure. You help people to get in balance. You detect whatever's out of balance, because so many of these things can contribute to stress on the kidneys and subsequent kidney failure. So that's it for what can go wrong. We've talked about overall, we've talked about infection, bladder infection, cystitis. We've talked about kidney infection, and we talked about stones, kidney stones. We've talked about glomerulonephritis, and we've talked about kidney failure. So that's pretty much the kinds of things that can go wrong and the ways that you can detect those things. On our next presentation, we're going to talk about, now, what do you do about all this? What are some protocols? I've hinted to it today here, and we'll go into it in more detail on the next talk.